welcome back to Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With me today is a guy whose writing I've really loved for a long time and was so excited when he agreed to come on the podcast. So, Joe Posnanski, thanks so much for joining us. It's really an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. I love being here. It's great.
I'll give your bio only because I suspect that you would be too modest and leave stuff out. It's unbelievably impressive. So you've been named National Sports Writer of the Year by 5 different organizations. You've won 2 Emmys. You obviously are a senior writer at The Athletic, were a senior columnist for Sports Illustrated. You've written 5 books, most recently, I think, The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. But more than that, I mean, it's an impressive list, obviously. But there's something about your work that just is so relatable and fun. And I just, as a fan, have always kind of connected to it really well. And I suspect that's why a lot of people really love your writing. But anyway, pretty amazing career.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, that means a lot to me. You know, I mean, for me, it's been a wonderful career. And I think a big part of that has been that I, you know, try my best to write from the perspective of the fan. I try to write it so that it is relatable and so that, I'm not trying to, tell you I know more than you do, because I probably don't. And so it's a lot of fun and it has been great, and hopefully we can keep it going for a little while.
Yeah. I'm a insane lifelong Mets fan.
I do know this. Yes.
And, we have a new owner. And so, which has been getting, and he's been doing a great job in terms of with the New York sports media so far, getting good press, but kind of was curious to talk about him both in the terms of kind of maybe what you expect. But I guess the first question is this, which is, when it comes to rooting for sports teams, do you check your morals at the door, right? Because it's hard to argue that Steve Cohen's a good guy, right? He's had, he almost went to jail, paid a $1.8 billion fine to the SEC. He's the inspiration for the villain in Billions. But yet, as a very long-suffering Mets fan, I'm pretty happy to have him. Although, generally in life, I try to apply my morals to what I do. Do you think it's reasonable for fans to say we don't care who owns our teams as long as they'll spend money?
I don't know if it's reasonable, but I think it's normal. It's interesting. I should probably, I don't know if he's said anything about it, but I should probably ask Brian Koppelman, who created Billions, because I believe he's a Mets fan. Yeah. See how he feels about this.
Good question. I'll ask Brian too. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Look, my feeling on it is, that fans in general don't care about the morals of their owners if their owners are willing to spend money and create some success. And it's one of those really weird parts of being a sports fan, which is how much do you let the real world sort of seep into this imaginary fun sports world that we've created? And you, as a Mets fan, know. It's been really rough going for a long time. So you have a guy come in and say, hey, I believe this is a public trust. I believe this team is a public trust. I'm going to spend as much money as I need to spend. I'm not here to make money. I'll make money elsewhere. I am going to listen to you. He's going to take questions and suggestions from fans on Twitter. I mean, this guy could be the worst person in the world. Those are all too tempting, I think, for Mets fans to look past it. I've been very interested in seeing, I know a bunch of people who are in the media in New York, and I've been very interested in seeing just how much of his checkered, business history they would bring in when talking about him as the owner of the Mets. And so far I would say it's zero, yeah. I mean, it's nothing but this is the greatest thing to happen in the Mets since Tom Seaver. So, it's weird, and I'm not sure that we're really supposed to be checking our morals at the door for anything, but there's no question. And you see it everywhere. I mean, sports fans, they want to win, and they want their team to be a winner, and they don't want to be, pulled back or drawn away from that by what people do off the field. And it's, that's been a constant for a long time, I think.
And, you know, it's also the contrast. If you look at the other owners we have in New York, they're basically all Lucky Sperm Club members, right?
Right.
It's the Tish and Mara kids. It's Dolan. It's the Steinbrenners, you know, and so on. And Jeff Wilpon was the same thing. And so partly having someone that actually made the money and had the ability to do that feels like a big step up, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I mean, I think you can look at Steve Cohen as, you know, I mean, it's self-made and you know, he's been very much in the middle of things and there's no reason to doubt what he's saying now. You know, I mean, you can feel however you want to feel about his business ethics and you know, you mentioned some of the things that he's been constantly in trouble for, but you know, he comes in, I think there's no reason to doubt this guy's a real Mets fan. So there's a feeling that, hey, he's one of us, right? He's a guy that that if I owned a team, that's how I would do it. If I owned a team, I would spend as much money as necessary, do anything to make the Mets bigger than the Yankees. I, you know, this year is a very interesting year when it comes to free agency. There's so many interesting players out there. And the excitement about the possibility of the Mets being in on, you know, whether it's a great pitcher like Trevor Bauer or a great hitter like George Springer or both, you know, that's you're going to feel good about it. And like I say, I don't think that it's going to matter to you what the personal business ethics are of the person who is giving you all of this good news. This is Christmas for Mets fans.
Yeah. And it felt like with the Wilpons, you know, obviously I'm not super sympathetic simply because, you know, I'm such a long-suffering Mets fan.
Sure.
But it also felt like they had a little bit of kind of almost like Murphy's Law. You know, when they would try to be really bold and do things out of the box, like when they hired Brody Van Wagenen to be the GM, you know, that failed. When they would spend a lot of money on guys like Jason Bay or whoever, those all failed. Like whatever they tried to do in either direction never really seemed to work. Do you think some owners are just cursed?
I do think that some owners are cursed. In the Wilpons case, it never seemed like they seemed willing to try a bunch of different things, but it never felt to me as you know, just sort of a baseball observer, an analyst, and whatever it was, it never seemed all that well put together to me. You know, it's like, I don't know that anybody thought it was a great idea to spend that much money on Jason Bay. That just didn't. That
sure Jason Bay said, "Are you sure?" When they asked him,
yeah. Bobby Bonilla still gets paid,
right? Yeah.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. So, you know, so I don't know. I never thought they ran the club particularly well. It never felt like, you know, and of course at the end when they were so money strapped and, you know, so many other things were going on, you know, it felt like a real mess. But, you know, I thought they generally, at least in the early years, had good intentions. But as a Mets fan, you know, good intentions only get you so far.
Yeah, they get us to no World Series since 1986.
Well, that's not right. They had the one World Series. You had the Subway Series, right?
Subway Series, and then in 2015 against the Royals.
That's right. That's right.
Kind of cursed. Those are both actually kind of depressing World Series. you know, as someone who, you know, watches the World Series, no matter who's in it every year, those were particularly upsetting. You have a lot of Olympics background, and the Times had a piece today or yesterday kind of talking about, you know, the hopes by the IOC at least to kind of run the Olympics as normal next summer.
Right. What
do you think that they can, they will, they should? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, we want to start talking about evils in this world. The IOC has always been leading the charge, right? And
are they worse than FIFA or better? If you had like a pan,
you know what? It's funny. We have had numerous like sports writer, you know, like board question. Like we would sit like in a room and say, "Yeah, who's worse, FIFA or IOC?" I mean, it's closer than people. People generally would say FIFA's worse, but I'm not sure that's true. IOC has been, and IOC has a much longer history, you know, back in the days when they were, of course, manipulating the athletes and making sure that none of the money went to them and all these other things. So the IOC has a nice long history of being pretty awful. You know, I don't trust anything the IOC says. I don't know how they can already be planning for Tokyo to be this this, you know, I mean, they're trying to make it sound like that is going to be the thing that's going to bring us out of this pandemic, right? It's going to be the first bit of good news, I guess, to hit the world since COVID. It seems like an overreach. I don't know what it's going to be like, obviously, next summer. I mean, there's hope, and you know, obviously, we're all excited about the pandemic. The vaccine possibilities and all of that. But you know, the thing is about the Olympics, and I'm sure you know this, and have probably studied this. They're so often disastrous for the countries where they happen. I mean, it's in, I can remember in Athens, after the Olympics in Athens, it was just, you know, there was just fury about what an unbelievable waste of money this was and how little it brought to Greece. And, you know, of course, there have been countries now that pull out of even consideration because they just don't see the benefits. I mean, it's turned into this just giant, quagmire. And it's very difficult to see how this is going to be great for Japan. Of course, I love the Olympics. So, you know, you have this mix of things because the Olympics are so much of what sports should be about when you get to the athletes themselves and watch them, you know, really so many of them performing for the sake of the sport and the joy of the sport. And so I love the Olympics and very much want Tokyo to be a raging success that does sort of bring the world together in this way. I would love for that to happen. I'm skeptical. Let's just say that.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's sort of a couple of examples where it makes sense to host an Olympics, but they're pretty specific. You know, one would be, okay, maybe a city like LA that literally already has everything built, right? They don't have to build anything basically.
Exactly.
So that makes sense. Or you're Putin and you want to steal as much money as you can from the Olympics. I think Sochi, 40 billion on the books and like 20 billion in reality. Or you're China and you kind of want the validation for if you're an authoritarian society. Like I could see why it makes sense. Or Qatar with the World Cup, I guess, is the same way in 2022. It's funny, along those lines, there was a political shift. I think I wrote about this for Inc. actually, where for a very long time in the U.S., owners would hold mayors and governors hostage and say, if you don't give me the money for a new stadium, I'm moving to Florida or New Jersey or whatever it was, right? The politics have actually flipped on that, where now I think you actually are better off politically if you're a politician saying no to the team. And the voters actually at this point get it and appreciate it enough that you get more of a political pop out of being anti than pro. And if you look at two examples, in Oakland, Libby Schaaf, who's the mayor there, I think tried to work something out with the Raiders, but ultimately, you know, was only willing to go so far. They left and the voters reelected her very handily. And then in Atlanta, Kasim Reed, the Braves wanted, you know, a city funded stadium in downtown Atlanta. And he said no. And they ended up in the suburbs. I think they both actually saw their poll numbers go up from that.
I think you're right. It's very astute of you to see that shift, because I can remember, you know, being in very specific situations as a writer in Cincinnati when the Bengals were, I wouldn't say threatening to leave, but were, you know, at least playing around with the possibility of leaving for Baltimore. I grew up in Cleveland. Of course, the Browns made that same threat and did leave and go to Baltimore. So I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen in Kansas City. I've seen it happen in other places where, you know, it's the threat is scary enough, but even, you know, the idea of falling behind, right? Where it's, you know, that's the other big one. It's where you say, well, look, I'm not going to leave, but we can't compete with the stadium that we have. You know, we have to have more revenue brought in, and without the more revenue, we're going to be a loser, and you don't want that. So I think that those things have been effective in the past, but you're right. You are now seeing teams, whether cities, whether it's San Diego, whether it's Oakland, whether it's, you know, various other places that are saying, you know, St. Louis sort of in, you know, although that was a weird situation with the Rams, but you were seeing cities say, no, you know, we know that there's really, this is a loser financially for us, right? That you're not really, these new stadiums, nobody can really sell that, you know, that guilt, you know, glitter is gold kind of thing about stadiums anymore, that it's going to bring in all of this new business and all of these you know, tourists and all these other things. I mean, that doesn't hold up. So, you know, I do think people have generally caught on to that. And I think people don't want to spend their money for the most part on stadiums. And I don't blame them. Why should they? You know?
Yeah. If you look at, I've had this argument sometimes with a guy named Dan Doktoroff, who was running the effort to bring the Olympics to New York City in 2012. We wanted it. We didn't get it before. And because the stadium in Manhattan wasn't authorized by the state legislature, Hudson Yards was built in its stead. And right. It's like, that's the greatest thing that ever happened in New York. Right? Because like Hudson Yards is an amazing, I mean, COVID's hard for everybody, but overall an amazing economic engine. And the Jets would have played there 8 times a year.
Right.
You could almost see a world where teams have to, in order to get the public financing for stadiums, have to start going to third tier cities that really want the validation. So like, you know, Seattle wasn't willing to subsidize the Sonics Arena for Oklahoma City. That was a big deal, right? That they could have a professional sports team. And so, and they had all these civic boosters and local people who really cared. You know, maybe that's what you start to see are teams that ultimately end up in places that are just willing to pay for being considered a major league town, even if it doesn't make sense economically.
I think that's right. I think there always are those cities. I live in Charlotte, and I know that there's always talk here about building a baseball stadium to try to bring a major league team here. There's a real problem with that, though, that you obviously know, and that is that these stadiums only sustain you for a year or two, and then you're stuck in a place that might not just be able to bring enough people in. I mean, you know, people used Tampa Bay over and over again. The Giants tried to, you know, move to Tampa Bay to get a new stadium, and I guess it worked for them. Other teams talked always, you know, going back a long way about, you know, bringing it into that Tampa, St. Pete area. It's such a big area and there's so many people. And, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays are floundering. And of course, and they're really good. They're really good. They were just in the World Series. They're really good, but they're floundering. And a big part of that is because of the stadium. The stadium is not very good, and it's in a, it's not in a good location, and it's a dome in Florida, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And so there's a lot of problems that maybe could be fixed, but generally you can't look at what's happened in Tampa Bay over the last 15 years and see a lot of potential there. So, you know, there are cities like San Antonio. There are cities like, you know, we see what's happening in Las Vegas. There's cities like Charlotte. There's cities like Nashville. There's cities like Memphis that are out there and would probably be willing to do some things. Kansas City has been trying to get an NBA team for forever. You know, there are cities out there doing that, but you know, once you get past the you know, the glory of building a new stadium or new arena, I'm not sure these cities can sustain major league sports at the level that needs to happen. So it's a real question, I think.
And you think it's the city as opposed to the sports? Like, for example, baseball, which is my favorite sport, and I kind of just from your writing assume it's your favorite sport.
Sure, my favorite sport. Yep.
Fair to say. It may, as an overall business, be going in a direction where a second-tier, third-tier city and a game that's kind of maybe in some ways in its decline, or a really tough combination. But, like, I was in Vegas on Monday, actually, for business, and, like, you know, went past the T-Mobile Arena, and, like, they're rabid, those hockey fans.
Yes. Oh, you know? So yeah.
Maybe it's partly, you know, if a sport is either staying or growing, like the NBA – or, you know, look, there weren't that many people out and about on the strip on Monday, but those who were that I saw, a lot of Raiders gear, right? So people there were really excited. Maybe it also depends on both the, you know, the sport and the city. Are you bearish or bullish on baseball's future overall?
Well, I don't know that I'm either. You know, a lot of people are obviously bearish about the future of baseball, and there are a lot of reasons to be. I mean, you see the numbers of you know, how old the average fan is. I mean, I think last I saw it was, you know, 8 or 9 years older than the NBA or NHL and even more than the NFL. That's a terrible, terrible sign for the sport. We've all seen the declining ratings, particularly in national games. It's become so much more of a local game, which is another reason why I think it is very difficult for Major League Baseball in particular, with a 162-game schedule and all those other things that make the game specifically unique. because of those things, I think it'd be very difficult for baseball to go to, you know, I don't know if they're second tier cities, but cities that right now don't have Major League Baseball. I don't know that any of those cities could look that appealing when it comes to that much. So I can see lots of reasons to be bearish, but baseball's been through this for 100 years, more than 100 years. People have been talking about the death of baseball since the 1910s. I mean, I've done stories on this where I've written about it. You know, the game is facing some challenges that I think with smart management, which is no guarantee to say the least, but with smart management and with a sense of where the game needs to be going, you know, it is still wildly popular on a local level. I mean, I think, I don't know about this past year because it was such a weird year, but 2019, I think 15 or 18 of the markets, baseball was the number one show on television by far, which is, you know, that's a nightly show that people were watching more than they were watching anything else. That's, yeah, you know, that's
and live TV, right? You know, right now there's so, other than sports and news, there's no real reason for anyone to ever tune into anything specifically.
Exactly.
Greater as a result of the scarcity. And what about on the other side? Like, what do you think about esports or kind of the integration of sports betting and sports? Do you think that ultimately kind of saves all of it, or is it a fad?
I don't think it's a fad. I mean, certainly gambling's not a fad. I don't know what it looks like. And I think that's going to be the big question. I think esports in particular are fascinating. It's fascinating to see what the possibilities are of bringing some things together. You know, baseball is, I mean, it's the most traditional of all the American sports. It's the oldest. It's the one that I think you see the most people, you know, looking back in history. I mean, it's a big part of baseball's allure is being able to compare Mike Trout with Willie Mays or Mickey Mantle or something like that. So it's a challenge, but I don't think either of those things are fads. I think they're certainly going to play major, major roles in the NFL. I mean, you're already seeing it to a large degree. Certainly going to play major roles in the NBA, I would imagine in the NHL. Baseball, I don't think, can fall behind on those things. I don't know what it looks like I say, but I do think that gambling in some form and some version of esports and being connected to these games yourself is going to be a very, very big part of baseball's future.
Yeah. So you did earlier this year a list of the 100 greatest players of all time, counting down from 100 to one. And it was something that for me was really fun, not just because it was fun to look at every day, but my dad, I got him a subscription to The Athletic, and we debated pretty much every single day how we felt about it. And oftentimes, you know, where the disagreement came in is, like, I thought Bonds was perfectly placed, you know, from my view. And he, of course, he's 75, saw it differently. But he happens to be with me here today, and I told him on the podcast, and he's got some issues with you, so I'm going to bring him in. So, Gabe Tusk, why don't you slide your chair over and
okay.
tell us where you think Joe's list was off in your view. And you've been watching baseball for how long?
I started watching. I lived in Brooklyn about four blocks from Ebbets Field, and I lived near Ebbets Field, and I've been going to baseball games since about 1953.
That's awesome.
The 54 season when Willie Mays came back from the Army was a big deal.
Yeah.
And the Dodgers got Don Newcomb back from the Army that same year. So that was like, and the rivalries were great. I watched Willie Mays in the younger years before they moved, and clearly he was an incredible player. But from what I saw over the years, I thought that Mickey Mantle was a more talented athlete. He was faster. He was more powerful. It probably had a better hitting eye. It didn't have Willie's flair in the field or running the bases, but you know, I thought Mickey Mantle could have been higher. And the player that I loved watching the most was Ted Williams.
Sure.
And I wish I had Ted Williams at number nine because he won number nine or something. Is that what you did?
Yeah, I played around with some uniform things.
I got that, but I would like always have a bone to pick at Ted Williams. Just on numbers, Babe Ruth seems to be the guy that you gotta pick as the greatest.
Well, but the listeners should know that, and Joe, I guess this was sort of a big the big controversy. You didn't have Babe Ruth as number one.
That's right. I had Willie Mays as number one and Babe Ruth number two. And I think I had Mickey Mantle maybe number 11. Obviously the Mickey Mantle versus Willie Mays argument is one of the best in not just baseball history, but sports history, American history. It's like arguing best, general of the Civil War or something. I think it's a wonderful argument. For me, I mean, look, there you can look at these a lot of different ways. Mickey Mantle obviously was hurt a lot, and you look at the way he declined at the end. I mean, even though he was still an amazing hitter, and you're absolutely right, he did have a much better batting eye than not only Willie Mays, but just about anybody. I mean, he walked all the time and was just an extraordinary player. I just think when you put it all together and you look at just what an amazing defensive player Willie Mays was, what a great base stealer and base runner he was, you just put all of the things together, and the fact that his career was longer and it just extended out further, that's where it came up. The big argument, of course, that I heard from more people than anybody else was Babe Ruth versus Willie Mays. Babe Ruth versus Willie Mays. And you can't, there's no right answer that I can give that would tell you why I think Willie Mays was number one. I looked at them both. Obviously, nobody dominated the game the way Babe Ruth did, but he also dominated a very different game that was before it was, Jackie Robinson, before it was a night game, before it was an American game that was across the country. It was just very different. And at the end of the day, when I put the two together, it was Willie Mays number one and Babe Ruth number two, and a whole lot of people sending me angry texts and tweets and messages.
I thought it was great that you had Oscar Charleston where you did, because most people wouldn't have any idea who he was, and he was, from the thing, at least things you read about, this incredible baseball player.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of this thing. And by the way, I should say, since I'm on here, I might as well say this, it is going to become a book. The Baseball 100 is going to be a book that is going to be released next October for the World Series by Simon & Schuster. Avid reader, and it's I'm very excited about it being released to the public, because for now it has been behind the paywall at The Athletic, and now this is going to be there for everybody, so I hope people will love it. And one of my favorite parts of this was writing about the Negro Leagues players. I mean, it's been a passion of mine ever since my first book. Well, going way back, but going back to my first book, when I spent a year traveling the country with the great Negro Leagues player, manager, and spokesman Buck O'Neill. So there are, I believe, 10 Negro Leaguers in my Baseball 100. It might be 9. I can't remember. And most people will tell you, and I've done a lot of research on this, and there's a new book that came out in the last year about. Most people will tell you that Oscar Charleston was the greatest player in the history of the Negro Leagues, which could make him the greatest player of all time, and we'll never know. But he was one of those guys who could do everything. He played center field and was brilliant, and he hit with power, and he would was the fastest guy out there, and so it's one of the best parts of this amazing and joyful project that I did was getting to tell people about guys like Oscar Charleston. And people know about Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, but maybe they don't know as much about Buck Leonard and Bullet Joe Rogan and some of these other guys that I got to write about. So that was one of my favorite parts of the whole thing.
Yeah, there were occasionally, and I feel like I know baseball pretty well, occasionally you popped up a name on there. I'm like, wow, I've never even. So you had Trout at 27. If you had to guess, where do you think he lands if you were to make this list again in 15 years?
Well, if he keeps at this pace, I mean, he's certainly top 10, maybe top 5. There was an argument to put him considerably higher. He was another one that I rated based on his uniform number. But he is, I think you could make a very viable argument right now. And this is after, Mike Trout is 28 years old, I believe. He's been in the league for 8 or 9 seasons. And you could make the argument right now that Mike Trout is a top 15 player. I mean, I think that you could make that argument pretty easily. That's how dominant he has been. That's how, you know, and again, going back to the thing that I found to be the most compelling part of this was I was looking for players who could do everything. You know, there are certain players that Ted Williams might be the greatest hitter of all time. Ted Williams was not a, you know, a particularly interested fielder. He didn't particularly care about defense all that much. He couldn't really run, but he was the greatest hitter of all time. And I rated him sixth, I think, all time, you know, because of all things. But I love those players that can do everything, that can beat you in every way that that you can be beaten. You know, people that hit and they hit for power and they get on base and they steal bases and they take extra bases you know, do everything well. And that's what makes Mike Trout so wonderful, is that there's just no part of the game where he's deficient. He can do absolutely everything and beat you every way.
And will he be the greatest player to never win a World Series if that doesn't turn around for him?
He might already be. I mean, you know, obviously you can talk about Ernie Banks and you can talk about a couple of other people like that. But at 20, I guess he's 29, so he's been in the league for about 10 years. And at this point, here's what I believe. For baseball, it would be a real tragedy if Mike Trout never made the World Series. I think as great as he is, I think there's a large portion of the country that just maybe they've heard of him, maybe they haven't, but they haven't seen him, you know, not in the big moments. None of us have seen him with that kind of thing. So
all the Angels coming to Citi Field anytime in the last 10 years. I mean, maybe they had it, I just missed it. But, you know, we go to the games and like, I've never seen Mike Trout in person play.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So what I hope for is not to ask, you know, where he would rank, but for the Angels to get their act together and build a team around him and get that guy to the World Series.
So Joe, last set of questions, which is people, yeah, obviously we're back in the throes of a quarantine and pandemic and all of that. If people wanted to order some sports books apart from yours, what would you recommend?
Wow. There are just too many to name any, you know, sort of individual sports books. I mean, there are a few new ones that are out now that are coming out. I have found myself, there are a lot of people who are asking me, to write blurbs for their books, to write, you know, the little, yeah, you know, something on the back cover. So there are some very exciting new books that are coming out, over the next, few months, maybe once we get through this election, once we get Joe Biden installed as president, we can start thinking about some other things. And I think that would be a great time for people to, you know, there's a good Negro Leagues book coming out. There's a book about the Mets, that's coming out soon. So there's some exciting new books. You know, my favorite book, sports books, if people haven't read The Boys of Summer, I mean, it is a book that has just had a huge impact on my life. Roger Kahn had a huge impact on my life as a writer. And so, you know, that's one that I always say, you know, pick it up. Especially if you're a baseball fan, it's one that just really gets at the romance of the game but also gets at the humanity of baseball. So, of course I love that. For this podcast, I assume everybody here has read Moneyball
if you haven't read that, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast.
I was going to say, right. So I assume everybody has, but let me just say again how important that book is. And, you know, and obviously we can talk about how important it has been, around, you know, outside of baseball. I actually, one of the weirdest but most fun things I've ever done is I served briefly, as a consultant, at Fort Leavenworth. I was a Moneyball consultant. I literally was speaking to red team, members about how they can bring Moneyball into the military, which was really, really fun. So, I mean, it obviously has a huge impact everywhere, but you can't fully appreciate and understand what's happening in the game of baseball today if you don't read it. It is to me, the everything that you are seeing out there is in some way, shape, or form driven at least a little bit by Michael Lewis's book. And so I assume everybody's read it, but you know what? Read it again, because I think it's fantastic.
And is therefore Michael Lewis responsible for Kevin Cash pulling Blake Snell? decision of all time.
I've been meaning to text him to just tell him that it's his fault. He is not, of course. But, you know, I think when this thing, you know, has gone, I mean, and this is to me the one of the most fascinating things that's going on in sports, you know, much less baseball, is this, how do you play the game? Do you play the game to win only 100%, or do you play the game to win and also entertain, or do you play the game to entertain? Like, what is the, you know, where's the balance there? And right now the balance is 100% to win. And, you know, you can make a statistical argument that Kevin Cash did what he needed to do, that, you know, he had a pitcher who was about to face the lineup for the third time, had been disastrous pretty much every time he had faced the lineup for a third time. That Dodgers lineup is amazing. But then you and I both know, or all know, I guess, with all of us here, it was a terrible move. It was a, you know, you had a pitcher pitching, you know, about as well as humanly possible. You had a Dodgers team that was completely scared of him at that point. Nothing made the Dodgers happier than when Kevin Cash pulled him. So it was so clearly the wrong decision on so many levels, but you could make a statistical argument for it. So I think that's where the game is trying to find that balance. And that started with Moneyball for sure.
Joe, this was great. Thank you so much. And look, once hopefully we are done with the pandemic by October when your book comes out, I am opening up a bookstore somewhere in the East Village. I would love to host you and have you come, you know, read and sign autographs and sell books.
I will be there. Let's just count on it.
Fantastic. Great. Thanks again.